Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name's David Inch. Glad to have you with us this morning. In this first hour of our program, we'll be talking about the issue of missile defense for the United States, something that has been now a matter of debate for some time, at least as far back as the presidency of Ronald Reagan, although these systems actually predated Mr. Reagan. He made some proposals that put them in something of a different light. But at any rate, it's something that now, over the course of several presidential administrations, we have been discussing and debating. And it seemed, though, that in the waning days of the Clinton administration, there wasn't a great deal of enthusiasm for these systems. Mr. Clinton himself seemed rather ambivalent. And in fact, the fall before he was scheduled to leave office, he actually decided not to decide and leave the decision about further implementation and deployment of such a system to whomever the next president would be. Of course, it turned out to be George Bush, who had previously said he intended to build and deploy such a system, regardless of the objections raised by allies and former adversaries. So that is the point where we are now. And we'll try to talk a little bit about how this issue has developed over time and where we stand right now as we talk today with Bradley Graham. He is a reporter for The Washington Post and has spent more than 20 years working for the paper, reporting on various sorts of subjects, most of them, though, focusing on foreign and military affairs. And most recently, he completed a 6-year stint covering the Pentagon. He has authored a book that's out recently looking at this issue. The title is Hit to Kill, The New Battle Over Shielding America from Missile Attack. The publisher is Public Affairs, and the book is out now in bookstores if you would like to look at it. And of course, as we talk, if you have questions or comments, you want to be a part of the conversation, that's welcome. All we ask of callers is people just try to be brief so we can get as many callers in as possible. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Or if you match those numbers with the letters on the phone, you get WILL. Maybe not necessarily any easier, 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. But those indeed are the numbers. Mr. Graham, hello.
Good morning.
Thank you for talking with us today.
My pleasure.
I wonder if we could perhaps talk a little bit about how thinking on this issue changes from one administration to the next. But before talking about Mr. Reagan, it probably would be worth noting that even though we perhaps associate the idea of missile defense with him because he came along and said proposed a space-based system for one, and the other thing that he did that perhaps was new was he started talking about a system of a scope and a size that no one had ever imagined before and turned out perhaps to be not possible. But let's save that for a second, because in fact that we did have a system of ground-based missile defense back some time before Mr. Reagan. In fact, I guess it would be back before the ABM Treaty came into effect in the 1960s. What was it that we had then?
We had a system. It was actually just after the ABM Treaty. It was that it became operable, and then only lasted a few months. And that was the Safeguard System in the winter of 1975-76. Lasted a few months, as I said, because there were questions about whether it would be effective against a Soviet attack and what the how much it would cost to operate. So it was disbanded very quickly by Congress. But you know, the debate over missile defense does long predate Ronald Reagan. It actually goes back to the end of World War II when the Germans brought in the missile age when they started launching V-2s at Britain, and then the Americans discovered after the end of the war that the Germans had been working on a missile that might have spanned the Atlantic and been able to reach the United States. Of course, at that time, we didn't really have the technology to build a missile defense system, and research continued on a back burner at the Pentagon until the Soviets started building long-range missiles, and so by the mid-60s, the Pentagon was very, very eager to put up some kind of missile defense. And it was actually President Johnson and his defense secretary, McNamara, who proposed the first, what was then a limited, supposed to be a limited system. But it finally got approved by, and redesigned a bit by President Nixon at the end of the 1960s and got built, as I said, and went, became operable for a few months in 1975-76.
Well, is it the case, I guess, as I said, I think that what President Reagan did that that changed the terms of the debate a little bit, and perhaps the reason that it still has such a hold on people's imagination, is that he proposed a system he talked about it in terms of an umbrella, that a system that could protect the United States from a very large-scale attack. Making a promise virtually that we could build a system that nothing would get through.
That's what he had in mind, you know, and he became the evangelist-in-chief of the missile defense movement. His enthusiasm for missile defense was quite infectious, but the technology was certainly not there for the kind of space-based shield that would have guarded against a massive civilian attack that he envisioned, and hence the nickname Star Wars, after the popular science fiction movie of the time. By the end of his administration, the Pentagon had scaled back the focus of its technology. It had moved from space-based lasers to looking at space-based interceptors and land-based interceptors. But still, the cost was prohibitive at that point. And then with the end of the Cold War, it looked like the issue was had become a relic of the Soviet-American rivalry. And when President Clinton took office in 1993, his defense secretary, Les Aspin, declared the Star Wars era dead. They pursued missile defense, but it was for battlefield defense against shorter-range missiles, like, if you remember, during the Gulf War, the Patriot system that protected U.S. troops in Saudi Arabia and Israeli population centers. The Pentagon was all in favor of that, and so was the Clinton administration. But the idea of a long-range defense, a defense that would protect the continental United States and Hawaii and Alaska, that was relegated to a back burner until the late 1990s, which is when my book really begins, and the rogue state threat presented itself, and that's what recharged the whole debate over missile defense.
Mm-hmm. And to some extent, was it also the fact that we are now talking about this again has to do with the change of administration and the fact that within this Bush administration there were people who were, we might label, true believers, who always thought that it was a good idea and thought that it was a good idea a long time ago. And what's happened now is simply that now they're in a position to actually do something with their beliefs. I mean, is that part of the reason
that we're really talking about that? That has certainly kept the issue very much alive. You know, when the Republicans. A number of them had never lost hope and belief in the idea, and when they took charge of Congress in 1994, they continued to pressure the Clinton administration in trying to step up research and development on a missile defense system and commit to a specific deployment date. And George Bush made clear during the campaign in 2000 that if he got elected, missile defense would be a top priority, and it certainly has been for his administration. He has increased the spending on research and development. He's begun a much more robust program of testing of various kinds of approaches to missile defense, and his idea is to see which ones look most promising in a little while and then go with them. He's looking at land-based interceptors, at sea-based interceptors, at an airborne laser, at a space-based laser, a whole host of different approaches. Mm-hmm. And he will see which one looks most promising.
I guess I find myself wondering whether also one reason that the this issue just never completely went away, and that we're now talking again about whether it's something we need, whether it's something that can be accomplished technically, and at what cost. But the reason that we're still talking about it is that for a lot of people, the appeal of missile defense goes somewhat beyond logic. That is, it resonates with people on almost a gut sort of a level.
Oh, absolutely. You know, one question I kept asking myself throughout the research and writing of the book was what is it about missile defense that has made it so controversial for so long? I mean, it really is sort of the great phoenix of American national security policy. It seems to keep rising from the ashes of Washington policy debates. And I concluded that there's really no one single reason, but a number of factors. I mean, one, of course, is just look at what's at stake. I mean, it's survival in an age of nuclear weapons. And for decades, we had this doctrine called mutual assured destruction, or MAD for short, that managed to avoid nuclear war and was based on the idea that you didn't need a defense. In fact, the defense was destabilizing. All you really had to have was, have Washington and Moscow each be threatening to annihilate the other if either one fired a nuclear weapon. So there's a natural reluctance to change this kind of strategic balance. And also, there's no scientific certainty about whether missile defense is even doable. You know, the scientists appear as divided sometimes as the politicians over whether this thing would work. And another factor is cost. I mean, this is going to be very, very expensive no matter how we do missile defense. But, you know, I think ultimately the passions that are aroused by this issue, as you say, especially the enduring nature of this whole controversy, you can't explain simply by differences over deterrence theory or scientific capabilities or budgetary trade-offs. There's a certain sort of, I think, transcendent, almost symbolic significance that this issue's taken on. It's kind of become a proxy between the political left and the right, a sort of a litmus test for how you keep America secure. Whether you do it by arms advances or arms control or military buildups or diplomatic building blocks, and when you get to this level of argument, there's a kind of a fervor to it that's akin to sort of clashes over theology. You know, there's almost religious ferocity to the partisan wrangling, and you hear it in the terms that are thrown around. I mean, proponents talk about the morality of erecting a national defense. You'll hear President Bush say he's for missile defense because it's moral, it's the right thing to do, whereas the critics will talk about the sanctity of existing treaties, especially the 1972 Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty that bans a national defense. And so, you know, you get the feeling sometimes you're actually watching a deeply emotional, theological debate.
Our guest this morning at this hour of Focus 580 is Bradley Graham. He's a reporter for The Washington Post. He's the author of a recently published book that looks at the debate over missile defense. The title of his book is Hit to Kill, The New Battle Over Shielding America from Missile Attack, published by Public Affairs. And your questions are welcome. And we have someone here ready to go. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, toll free 800-222-9455. Here's the caller. Line number one. Hello.
Oh.
Yes.
Mr. Graham, one of the things that seems to be missing from this, the coverage of this issue, is the absence of an appetite to follow the money. We're talking about, at least what I read, $100 billion over the long haul. That's a lot of money available to a lot of companies. One of the reasons that missile defense issue has been kept alive may well be the Heritage Foundation, which is one of the most effective GOP conservative think tank lobbies in Washington. And it's been pushing this idea since 1980 and won't let it go. Now, my question is, can you please tell me who the companies are? Let's follow the money. Who the companies are who would benefit most from the outlay of that kind of cash pool.
When you look at who's building, or at least who's experimenting with various missile defense systems, you find it's a who's who of the defense industry. You find all the big ones. Boeing is the lead coordinator right now, but Raytheon has a big chunk of it. Lockheed Martin has a big chunk of it. TRW is doing a lot of the computer work. They are all in it, but. There's a two-edged sword to this for these companies. Certainly, if this program ever really got off the ground, there would be big bucks in it for them, and they see that. On the other hand, there have been so many stops and starts over the past few decades that these companies have become somewhat wary of putting their best and their brightest on the project. This is what the Pentagon found in the last few years, even though the Clinton administration a couple years ago said, okay, we're going to get serious now about testing, and here's some more money to do it, and they gave this contract to Boeing to pursue this system. After the first few failures in the tests, the Pentagon got very frustrated and found that Boeing and Raytheon and the others hadn't put their A-team folks on the program, and they said, "Look, you know, this is intolerable." So that has changed. There have been some management shakeups. The last test worked. Another one's coming up this weekend. Their quality control, by all accounts, has improved, and so it looks like there's a sense in the industry, too, that this administration, the Bush administration, is as serious as any before it about actually erecting a system. And certainly, as you suggest, groups like the Heritage Foundation, there are a few others in Washington, deserve a lot of the responsibility for keeping this issue alive. And they do get some of their funding from industry, but I often hear it say that the one reason that missile defense has been kept alive is because, you know, the conventional military industrial complex. That I actually think missile defense may be an exception to that rule, because of the deep commitment that many in the Republican Party have, many in certain conservative think tanks have to this issue. I don't think they've needed help from the defense industry all that much. They don't need that kind of lobbying. And certainly the Pentagon itself has through much of this period, not been pushing this issue. You know, the chiefs have been lukewarm at best to the idea of a national missile defense system. They're worried that it's going to take away money from other programs, modernization and transformation programs that they prefer to see the funds spent on.
How much has been spent so far?
Well, by one very thorough tally that was done several years ago, the totals come to more than $100 billion in current dollars over the last 50 years, and that includes the safeguard system that existed briefly in the mid-70s and all the work during the Reagan years on various systems. We still don't have a system. And a lot of people, surprisingly, if you look at the public opinion polls, actually think we do have a system. You know, about two-thirds of Americans, when polled, will say that they believe we could already knock down a missile if it were launched at the United States. And you can't blame them because they've been hearing talk about missile defense for years and years. They see it in the movies, you know, and so they think we can do it. But we have no such capability, secret or otherwise, at this point. We're still quite a ways from it, and we're spending right now several billion dollars a year still on trying to develop some kind of approach that will work.
Well, just for I have a caller, and I promise I'll get to this person right in just a second. But just to take this one step further, we talked about the fact that the scientific community is divided about whether technically such a thing is possible. And we've talked about the fact that there's been a lot of work done and a lot of money has been spent, and we're not there yet. Is it the feeling, do you think, as you talk to people, do you get the feeling that people believe that if we wrote a blank check, if we said we will spend whatever it takes, that it would be possible to get there, or whether that it's not really a matter of money, that it's more a matter of technology, and it wouldn't matter how much we decided to spend, that it's still not likely anytime soon we could get a workable system?
Well, you could probably get a debate over whether it's ever doable, but even some of the critics of the approaches that have been tried say that if we just tried some other approaches, it might work. I mean, and if we had limitless amounts to spend on it, it would I think you'd see more progress. The whole effort has been hampered by a number of considerations, not just money. I mean, we've had this treaty for 30 years that has prohibited research on some of the approaches that would be perhaps most promising. I mean, many experts say that if you could start from scratch and design a system, they say that the best system would be something in space, you know, with lasers and so on. You could get missiles just as they're lifting off, and then you wouldn't have to worry about this problem of decoys, you know, which is a problem with this land-based system that we now have. If you wait to try to hit a warhead when it's up in space, it's got time to release all kinds of decoys that complicate the homing problem. But so if you could just design a system based in space, that would be the optimal. But that technology we haven't really been able to pursue because of treaty concerns, and it's the least developed. So we've been fiddling with a system of land-based interceptors, but we've made a number of advances in sensors and computer processing that make it look more promising, but it still has this very serious decoy problem that has yet to be demonstrated we can surmount.
We'll take a caller here now. The person has been very patient. We'll get to them. Champaign County, line one. Hello.
Yeah, and you haven't even mentioned alternate delivery and alternate attack and all that. A cruise missile is still fairly sophisticated, but is not really too attackable by the methods, I guess, with a space-based thing, which is really the big motivation of Rumsfeld and all of his space commission work. But I wanted to, just the way you presented the Patriot as, you know, defending our, you know, our troops in Israel and the Gulf War rang a bell. You know, I assume you interviewed Postal, Theodore Postal, MIT.
Yeah, he's in the book.
Under a lot of pressure now because of his willingness to discuss the negative aspects of this. The Patriot didn't do anything. If it did anything, it was by accident. And everybody still, it's a commonplace, you hear it all the time, that it was successful theater missile defense, and it wasn't. So, I mean, there are a lot of commonplaces built into the language. Well, another thing you just said was successful test. That's contested, too. Postel will tell you that it was a cooked test, and a lot of other people will tell you, people on this campus. But you just blithely, and I don't want to make it a personal attack because, but, you know, that rang some bells. That was not a successful test. It was cooked. And that's, we don't hear that enough. And you're just mouthing the commonplaces. The last caller's point, too, I think you deflected without really addressing it too well, which is there is a lot of money backing this. Maybe it's, you know, it's the Heritage doesn't get money dedicated from Boeing, but the whole industrial complex is really there, and it's really advocating this. Maybe it's not the first thing on their list when they're fighting over the tactical strike fighter and that sort of stuff, but it's definitely in their long-range plans, and there's anyway, well, that's enough for you to counter for a little while. Maybe I'll have a follow-up.
Okay. Well, the book is very thorough on what happened at each of these tests. I had rare for a journalist anyway, to actually be present for the last two tests out in the testing range in the Kwajalein Atoll. So I go through what went wrong and what went right. And in the case of the two out of four tries where they actually hit, they did hit. Now you can there have been questions, legitimate questions raised about just what that shows. And in fact, the tests were simplified in a number of ways, not in ways that the Pentagon didn't talk about. I mean, they were clear to anybody kind of, you know, taking the time to look at the details. I think some of the reporting has been a little confused about that, but then some of the Pentagon accounts initially have been confused about just what went wrong. But there's no question that there are many artificialities involved, many surrogates used in these initial tests, and that's the nature of these first tests, and the Pentagon has presented them simply as proof of principle kinds of tests. They are not saying that these tests show that this system will be able to work under more stressful conditions of actual combat. There's a long way to go, and I'm clear on that in the book, and those involved in the program have been clear on that. My reference to the Patriot was simply to I didn't mean to suggest that the Patriot worked or not, but it was simply to call attention to how that issue became much in the headlines of the issue of battlefield defense, and the threat to troops in the field from shorter range missiles like the Scud was very much in the news during the Gulf War, and it did have an impact, particularly on Congress, and helped passage of the 1991 Missile Defense Act. And for a very short time, there was actually a consensus between Republicans and Democrats about the need to move ahead with missile defense. And certainly the images of Scuds attacking U.S. troops in Saudi Arabia and Israelis reinforced the need for battlefield defense. But of course, the Patriot had many problems that Postal was a lead. It took the lead in outlining to people.
The point is that it was a fraud, whether it was conscious or whether it was what I think it was consciously manipulated. I think people knew that it really hadn't done any good, and you know, calling this test well explained by the Pentagon, and then saying that maybe some of the initial stuff was confused. I think you're obfuscating, the point is that those tests were not a fair test of whether in the long run it's going to work. I think that you can dump enough money on it, but what cost? And maybe you do lay that out, but I'm just saying what you're presenting to the casual listener is not very clear. The Patriot did push through this, and it was a fraud, and to call the last test without explaining it in the next breath a very limited test, I mean, I don't feel like you're doing much on the air here to further the debate. Now, maybe in the text you have this all outlined, and then the point about the defense triangle and the amount of money that's just constantly being spent to support more military spending of whatever shape, to be able to say that that's not really the case for missile defense, I don't buy it.
Well, let me see if I can take one more pass at this issue of the tests. The tests have not been presented as proof that in the long term the system can work. They have been presented as proof of principle of whether you could do hit to kill under very simplistic conditions. But in the first case, the first one that that actually hit, the booster was not the real booster that is going to be used in the test. A number of the computerized systems that are going to be used were not working. I mean, it was just a matter of sending up this kill vehicle, this interceptor, into the right pocket in space and seeing if, once it opened its eyes, it could home in on the target missile. That in itself is no small feat, and they managed to do that. Then they failed a second and a third time for reasons that had nothing to do with the new technology. There were glitches in the old technology, very simple kinds of mechanical things that went wrong. In one case, the plumbing of the kill vehicle. In another case, the avionics in the booster that failed to allow for separation. And by the fourth test, where they did hit, they had more elements involved. The computer management system had come online. They were using this a prototype radar that would be in the actual system. So it was more of an integrated test than the very first one. But still, there were many artificialities in the test. The booster was still not the one. It was slower than the one that they had. They eventually expect to use. The geometry has been the same in all four tests. They're using the same same pattern. They intercept in the same place. The target is launched from California. It arcs over the Pacific. The interceptor goes up from an island in the Central Pacific. And this is only testing one kind of scenario. So there are many artificialities. They've had to put a beacon on the target to provide some initial tracking, not final homing information, but initial tracking information, because of the artificialities of this scenario. All of that is discoverable. It's not hidden in the program. The program, over the years, has indeed suffered from credibility problems. In 1984 and again in 1991, tests on earlier systems were later revealed to have been rigged in ways that the Pentagon had not disclosed. And the current group of testers and officials managing the program are very mindful of this and of what happened in the past. They do suffer sometimes from not explaining fully and not just getting down and laying out everything at the first press conference that they give on these questions. But I also then think that there is some distortion that ends up in some of the media accounts about just what is being done. I mean, for instance, in this last test, the presence of this beacon on the target missile was well known to anybody who studied the details of the test, but it was presented as somehow rigging the test. But it had been explained and the need for it, and also what the limitations were in as a result in terms of interpreting the test of having that beacon there.
We just let me jump in here because we're moving into our last 15 minutes, and I have two other callers that I want to try to get. I hate to belabor this point, but just maybe let me ask one further question. It begins to sound as if whether one thinks missile defense is a good idea and can be made to work, or whether one thinks it's a bad idea and can't be made to work, you could, either of these people taking either of these positions, you could use the tests that have been conducted so far to support your case. I mean, it sounds like you can argue it either way. Is that right?
Well, you can't. It's a stretch to use the tests to say that this is proof that missile defense eventually work in the way it has to work.
Yeah.
You could take some encouragement that it will, but you can't say that these tests have proven that. So in that sense, you know, the critics are right to say, you know, show me. You still haven't shown me. But what the proponents are saying is that, look, we've got to do this a step at a time. Right now we're proving the principle of hit to kill. We've gotten now closer to doing it than we have before, and we're gonna eventually demonstrate it. But you still have to take him on faith.
We are talking this morning with Bradley Graham. He's a reporter for The Washington Post, has been at the paper for more than 20 years, reporting on foreign and military affairs. His book, which has been out now for a little while, is titled Hit to Kill, The New Battle Over Shielding America from Missile Attack, published by Public Affairs. We have several callers. We'll try to get everybody. Next up is Savoy, line two.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
There's been several really good articles published over the years in Scientific American, and two of the articles were authored by Robert McNamara, and it was really the calculation of just what does a mutually assured destruction mean. You'd be surprised at the assets, the small number of assets that have to be destroyed in a first strike to cripple an economy such as the United States. And this is the reason missile defense is good. It doesn't take 100 warheads to obliterate this country. It only takes 10 or 12 warheads to explode over important targets to really destroy our way of life and economy and set us back 100 years. This is the reason that missile defense is a good strategy. The key thing in first strike is uncertainty. If your enemy is not certain that he can accomplish this task, he's not likely to attack. And then it's good to know that even one missile getting through during an attack is going to create untold damage in this country, and the costs are incalculable, and therefore the system is very cheap. If you could get one to even function, you know, 33%. What you go and do, you don't shoot at it once, you shoot at it 9 times, and you're bound to hit it.
Well, Mr. Graham, you have a comment on that?
Sure. Well, you make a good point in noting how the system is likely to work. We're not going to, it's not planned that we'll just shoot one interceptor up to try to get one warhead. The idea is to take multiple shots, and that should increase the chances of hitting an enemy warhead. And it's certainly true that if one gets through, you'll have an incalculable damage, but you hear the Bush administration arguing that it still may be worth putting up a system that isn't 100% effective. And the reason being that there is some value to just dissuading and deterring potential adversaries in thinking raising the cost for them and the risk for them in trying to fire at us. So that's another factor that has slowed the Pentagon down up to now, which was a requirement for 100% or close to 100% effectiveness. The Bush administration has effectively removed that and has made clear that they are ready to deploy a rudimentary system in as little as a few years, even if it's far from 100% effective.
Well, then I think that still, though, there is something in all of this that I think a lot of people simply don't understand. It doesn't make sense to them. And that is that supposing that we build a system and a rogue nation launches 2 or 3 or 4 or, you know, some relatively small number of missiles with nuclear weapons at the United States. And even if the system, you know, maybe the system we have works pretty well but doesn't work completely well, and one gets through and it destroys New York City, certainly the damage to New York and to this country would be great and perhaps incalculable. However, whoever launched that attack, I think we would assume, would not have a parallel system of defense, and that the United States would be left with enough power so that if we used it to the maximum, we could wipe that country off the face of the earth. So the question that I think most people ask is, why would any rogue state, knowing that we had that capability to retaliate, why would they do it?
Well, this has always been the basis of deterrence theory, was that this notion that whoever shot at us would be risking annihilation. But the problem with that, the Achilles heel of that theory has always been the illogical, the suicidal leader. And somehow that seems much more of a possibility in the wake of the suicide terrorist attacks on September 11th. But there still is evidence out there that those who we sometimes glibly think of as crazy, for some reason we think of some third world rogue state leaders as somewhat less rational than the Soviet leadership was. But there's evidence out there that they would behave as rationally as the Soviets did and hold their fire. I mean, Saddam Hussein is often described as having withheld the use of chemical weapons during the Gulf War because of some very clear warnings from the United States that doing so would have brought annihilation on Baghdad. But apart from that, what finally drove the Clinton administration, as I describe in my book, to getting more serious about missile defense, was the notion that deterrence, even if you assume it would work, it could use a little help these days, its own insurance policy. And so why not, if you could show that the technology and the cost were, the technology was there and the cost was affordable, why not build a system? It would make attack by a rogue state not only fatal but futile. And that was... That was how they squared moving ahead with a missile defense with traditional deterrence theory.
Let's go to another caller. This is Ken Mundy, and it's line number 4. Hello?
Hello.
Yes.
2 points. One is that it would be very easy to put decoys in with your missile, put a missile in a Mylar balloon and put up another 10 or 20 or 30 balloons floating along with it so that you wouldn't be able to hit the warhead. But secondly, more important is the ease of smuggling a bomb in to the United States. All they have to do is put it in a cargo container and ship it to any place in the United States they want to and have it go off. What are your views on that?
I think the decoy problem, as you say, is the biggest technological hurdle for any kind of hit-to-kill system. It's why you see a number of people now... looking more intensely at the boost phase kind of system, where you try to hit an enemy missile soon after liftoff before it has time to disperse its decoys. But there are great challenges in accomplishing that as well. And as for other threats, this is a very very lively argument. Of course, is what is more likely. A suitcase bomb or a nuclear device smuggled into this country or a long-range missile. And I think the intelligence community, I mean, they have, and those at the Pentagon have attempted to rate these various threats, and long-range missile attack tends to rate lower on the list of likely occurrences than something like a smuggled but this argument has just been fanned by the events of September 11th. You have critics of the saying, "See, we told you so." The real threat to the United States is not a high tech missile, but a low tech attack. Proponents have been saying, if terrorists could do what they did just by hijacking several airliners, imagine what they could do if they ever got their hands on, or a rogue state got its hands on a long-range missile tipped with a nuclear weapon. So the um, while the likelihood of a missile launch may be less, the potential consequence of it could be much greater than even the of some anthrax in a subway in a major city.
We'll try to get one more caller quickly here in on a car phone, line one. Hello.
Hi. I just wanted to make one very brief comment. You said that most people seem to have a perception that it's third world countries or rogue states that would have a crazy leader. There is, in fact, a considerable school of thought that says that that's actually how the Soviets viewed Reagan, specifically after he made that on-air comment, "I've declared war on Russia and we'll be bombing Moscow in 5 minutes." So the craziness idea can apply to major powers as well as any other nation. That's all I wanted to say. Thank you.
All right. Well, Mr. Graham, you want to comment on that at all?
No, I definitely think that's true. It's not just, I mean, those who've been critical of deterrence theory have said that we've just been very lucky that there have been, in assuming that even those who run big countries will behave logically.
We're almost at the point we have to finish. I just real quick, now, where are we now in terms of funding that has recently been approved?
The Bush administration had asked for an increase in missile defense funding from $5.3 to $8.3 billion in fiscal 2002, and the Democrats in Congress were balking at that before September 11th. But afterwards, they said, "Well, we're not going to get into a partisan fight about this now." So they've given the administration all the money it wanted for testing for this year, and so the administration has embarked on this very broad, robust testing program of various approaches, and the next test of the land-based systems coming up. Well, it was supposed to be tonight. It's been postponed a couple days. It's now due this Saturday night.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks very much for talking with us.
Oh, appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Our guest, Bradley Graham, he's a reporter for The Washington Post. And if you're interested in reading his book, again, the title is Hit to Kill: The New Battle Over Shielding America from Missile Attack. It's published by Public Affairs.